as we've done in previous meetings, let's take a look at any conceptual points or translation points that you'd like to inquire about. Randy. Hold it. You want to put the other mic out there? So
in verse 20,
yeah.
I understand the opponent inside, which is one's own anger. What's the opponent outside? Is that someone else's anger?
It's anybody you're fighting with. You know, for me, insurance companies, computer support people, the cable guy, sometimes students. That makes sense to you?
Well, the opponent makes sense, the subdue.
Well, yes, it's interesting because Art sent me an email and saying, what's the subdue business? The word in Tibetan, in both cases, it's different forms of tulwa, which is basically to. It's related to the word for discipline or to tame. You could say tame, actually, but to render not harmful. It doesn't necessarily carry the connotation that subdue tends to in English, which is to bring under your power, though I suppose tame does have that idea as well. Nava's just given me this to conquer and bring into subjection, that's not it. To bring under control, especially by an exertion of the will, that's probably closer to it. To bring under cultivation, definitely. It's from the Latin, from the Middle English, but eventually originally from the Latin, to lead under. Which and has actually the same root as seduce. Thank you. Certainly open to an alternative word. I don't think we'll use the word seduce. That was a joke, if anybody was interested. Pardon? I have a problem with tame. I get a picture of a master of ceremonies in the center of a circus with a whip. You know, tame. I may be quite wrong, but it carries or you know, like you tame a horse. There's for some reason it carries for me an implied sense of force. Julia?
There's a beautiful book called Bandula about the man that introduced different methods of elephant taming into the plantations in Burma, mm-hmm. where he used kindness and gentleness and sort of reward system of training for elephants. So that's not force, that's more encouragement in a direction.
Right. When I say force, I'm thinking of you're bringing something under your will, which is...
Oh, yeah.
So mm-hmm. that's why I've never... Because you have the same verb being used to describe what Buddhas do to sentient beings. Song Jeji, Semchen Tamchen Dul. It's the same word, essentially. And it's often translated as tame sentient beings. Well, I don't want to be a tame sentient being. Thank you. Michelle.
Well, I agree with you that it does have this kind of inherent quality of superiority. But along the lines of what Julia said, the first thing I think of with the word tame is the little prince. And when the little prince meets the fox, and the fox says, "You must tame me." And then says something to the effect of, "And then we will be friends forever and ever."
But he instructs
the little prince on how to do that.
Okay, yeah.
So it's very much a case in which the being that is tame does not give up his own power.
In that context, yes. John? Point the mic towards your...
Yesterday morning, I got halfway down the street to go way out to pass the 405 and realized that I didn't have my wallet with me. And turned around and came back because I don't like to go off without a driver's license. I couldn't find it anywhere, and I just broke down and had a total shit fit.
A temper tantrum.
Spoiled little boy, couldn't get what he wanted because he was belayed. At any rate, I realized that I'd come down, having come down from the retreat, I stopped at Whole Foods way out in... We're at Monrovia, I guess, wherever it is out there, and had left it there. So it all came. What I realized from that was that I really was still looking for pleasant things to happen for me, instead of accepting the challenge of not. Having it all my way. So where was that, what would that anger be called?
Well, that's the opponent inside, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so we have subdue, tame. Maybe there are other possibilities. We can come back to that. But you're clear about the meaning, are you, Randy? Okay. Any other? And I want to come back to this verse and talk about its meaning at some depth. But I'd like to continue and make sure that all the translation or conceptual points are cleared up first. Any others in any of these three verses? Michelle? Now we can have one over there and one here, and that'll be fine.
In verse 22, the word fixations. I always wonder about that word. You know where that comes from. In my other little translation here, it uses the word duality,
mm-hmm.
which seems, you know, different than fixation.
Well, yeah. What's the whole translation you have there?
Appearances are one's own mind. From the beginning, mind's nature is free from the extremes of elaboration. Knowing this, not to engage the mind in subject-object duality is the bodhisattva's practice.
Okay. I just wanted to... I was curious if they put subject-object in there. I mean, if I want to be really fussy, subject-object duality is like a little redundancy. But the phrase in Tibetan is zungzin. Both words essentially mean to hold. They're to hold or take hold of. Zung is to take hold of an object out there or having taken hold of an object out there, you cling to a subject in here. So the key point in Zung Zin, it refers to this dual process of fixing an object out there as something real and fixating something inside as something real. So the actual word in Tibetan is to hold, to take hold of, and that's why I used fixation. They translated Dzogchen as subject-object duality. Nothing really wrong with that, except it loses that sense of fixating, which is why I put that in there. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Is it the same as attachment then, or similar to?
Well, in the larger picture, yes. But more precisely, this fixating on subject-object is the basis of attachment. Okay? Deborah had a question.
I have a little confusion over the first line of 22.
Whatever arises and experiences your own mind?
Yes. Some of the other translations in the Dalai Lama's commentary indicate that that it's merely what mind and delusion creates. But I'm also reminded of my experience is true being. I just don't get. Is experience not true being? It's all in your mind. What's going on here?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. The Tibetan says, "Whatever arises, whatever appears." That is one's own mind. That's what the Tibetan says literally. Now, that whatever appears, there has a fairly wide range of meaning. When we say I'll put it this way. Ordinarily, we think that our perspective is that things appear to the mind, right? And the basic Buddhist perspective here is that, no, nothing appears to the mind. Whatever appears is the mind. and it's... probably some schools might say that because they use the word sem here, which is citta in Sanskrit, it's the word for mind, they mean the delusional mind. But to me, that is reading something that isn't really in the Tibetan. That would be like a particular tradition's commentary on it. But I think but the idea that whatever appears is the mind, that's a very important point in Buddhism, and I want to talk more about that when you start talking about reflection, but that is what it means. Where do you want to go from?
But how does that relate to give me energy to know that experience is pure being?
Ah. What is? Okay. There are various ways into this, but I'll take one that is used all the time, just to be safe. First, we come to understand that what arises as experience is mind. Secondly, then we look and say, what is mind? And when we look at mind, we see nothing there. It's empty. And then we look at okay, so everything's empty. What's that knowing? And that's where you begin to get into pure being. If you, there's a verse that Boka Rinpoche taught me a very long time ago, which I liked. That's why I brought this along this evening. After the awareness that there is nothing other than mind, that means all experience is mind, okay, comes the understanding that mind too is nothing itself. The intelligent know that these two understandings are not things, And then, not holding on to even this knowledge, they come to rest in the realm of totality, pure being. So there are actually four levels of understanding there. And when it says in our prayers, give me energy to know mind is pure being, it's telescoping those four levels of understanding. Okay? Julia.
Yeah, I had a similar, a related question in verse 21. Any object that you attach to?
Yes.
So objects. Did you elaborate on objects?
Here, that's 21, right? Here we are. Well, I had to put an object there because it says whatever you attach to. Let's see. Gangla Jenchak Chewi Nguponam. I'm sorry, no, it's not quite right. Here it says all. Yeah, all things, all substances, which produce attachment, is a little more literal. So I just turned the English around.
So that would include thoughts such as the one that these two understandings are not things.
Those are very subtle levels, but the basically, any time you regard something, you experience something as other than mind, you're going to do one of three things with it. You're either going to be attracted to it, you're going to be averse to it, or you're going to be indifferent to it. And then you go from there. And here, 21, there we are. This verse is referring to the process of attraction. And in order to be attracted to something, you have to regard it as something other than you. Okay.
Why?
You can't be attracted to something you regard as you. If you experience it as you, how can you be attracted to it? No. But if you look, exactly, you're viewing yourself as something you're intensely attracted to. But you, but it's that alienation from yourself, which is the problem. And so you're trying to feed it all the time. Okay. Any other translation or conceptual points? Yes.
So 21 refers not just to sensual pleasures, but to anything to which you attach.
Well, this is what we're going to go through when we go through a deeper level of meaning, because at the outer level it's referring to sensual pleasures, but then you start cutting down in meaning to the deeper level. So it is anything which you're attracted to. And the Yeah, I'll just leave it there for now. Okay. Anything else then? Napa? Yeah,
I don't know if this is the right time to ask. I kept wondering why on 20, when we're dealing with anger, he says master it with loving kindness and compassion. I mean, Shantideva spent a whole chapter of patience on half of it on anger. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So why does he choose here loving kindness and compassion as an antidote for anger?
Instead
specifically, very specifically here.
Instead of patience or something like that?
Yeah, maybe patience, okay. Yeah.
You're probably going to have to take that one up with Tomei Zongpo. I mean, there are many Buddhism is very full of methods, and many methods can be used in for many different things. It's not one method for this and one method for that. It's very rich. I would speculate that Tome Zongpo is speaking out of his own experience. This is what he did with anger. In the three-year retreat, the first three-year retreat, when we got to the part of the retreat on taking and sending, and Rinpoche gave us 2 months on taking and sending, I used the first month to... I did 2 weeks on loving kindness and 2 weeks on compassion, just the straight traditional meditations that you find in Jewel Ornament of Liberation. And that was really pivotal for me. I mean, it's really tough meditations, but they've really shifted something in me very deeply. And I know that because I got a note from my wife, who's in the women's retreat, saying, people say you have changed a lot and you're much easier to live with now. Nobody told me in the retreat. Because they all sent notes to the women's retreat saying, thank God Ken's been doing these meditations. And then I did the last month on taking and sending, and I found that experience of really working with the four immeasurables changed my whole relationship with taking and sending. And because of that, almost everybody that I work with, I really encourage them and direct them to do a very solid training in the four immeasurables before they do taking and sending. In the second three-year retreat, when we got to this part of the retreat, our retreat director gave very, very different instructions on actually what I felt is a somewhat unrelated meditation to everybody. And one day I was talking about this with him, in really good, nice bodhisattva way. I was arguing quite vociferously that he was screwing these people up by not having them do the four immeasurables. And he listened to me very patiently. And he said at the end, Ken, those meditations worked for you. They don't work for me at all. If you read Dalai Lama, when he discusses cultivating loving kindness and compassion, he says, you know, these are the traditional meditations. Those don't work for me at all. But here's something that one of my teachers gave me. This one worked for me. So one method doesn't work for everybody. Tome Zongpo is saying, this is what I... He's speaking out of his experience. This is how I came to terms with to work with anger. Other people can do it with very different techniques. So, there isn't just one right way of doing things. That's why we have a multiplicity of techniques, because you need to find the ones which actually work for you. It's one of the reasons why I encourage... when I'm working with students, if they say this isn't working, I'd rather do it this way, we talk about it very seriously and explore, and I'll explore their experience, and if it seems to be working, I will go with what they feel is working for them rather than saying, well, no, you have to do it this way. I think that's quite important. Okay. Does that help? Okay. Anything else?
Yeah. Can I just go back to fixation again?
Sure.
Whenever I come across it, I sort of get a blank spot, I think, because somewhere I think it's a piece of jargon that isn't in my language. Am I right in thinking what it actually means is something like a hardening around this idea of self and other, or object, subject, object?
At this point, for us, it is so fast and so immediate, we don't even notice it. I mean, you look at that, and you've already, even as it arises, you've seen it as something else, right? Now, when we're in retreat or we're meditating a lot, experience can shift. And the way we experience things can and does change. So we actually experience whatever is arising. When we're looking at it, we see I'm looking at my mind. It's a very different experience. And so that's one step away from this fixation. But when you say it's a hardening, yes, it is a hardening, but it's just like that. And you can't possibly get at this with the intellect. It's far, far more powerful than the intellect. The intellect actually is almost a manifestation of this, because when a thought arises, you see it as a thought which is coming to your mind. You don't experience the thought as your mind. You follow?
Yeah.
That's how immediate it is. So yes, it is a hardening, but what are you trying to understand here?
I'm trying to understand what the noun fixation, what process that indicates. I mean, I can understand I experience things as subject and object.
Mm-hmm.
Is that in itself the fixation?
That's a manifestation of the fixation, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, the fact that you experience things as subject and object is de facto the fixation in operation. And when the mind grows quiet and clear, and that's not too hard actually, then that fixation can release temporarily and you'll experience things in a different way. You won't experience them as subject-object. And then when there's a certain level of insight, then there's a much deeper shift. And then for really trained people who are very proficient, who have trained very deeply, they experience the arising of experience the same way that we would experience a dream if we knew we were dreaming. So it's a very different way of experiencing the world. That makes sense? Okay. Yes?
What are some of the other methods to deal with anger besides the four immeasurables?
He's particularly interested. Okay. Well, okay, let's move to the reflection part, reflection and meditation part of this then.
Ken, may I ask a question before we do that?
Please.
In your explanation to Joe just now, I would have thought that fixation is an outgrowth of the subject-object experience, not the cause of it.
No, it is the subject-object experience. That's what Kate's question was about. The Zungzin, it's the fixing of subject-object, and it's the operation of that framework in our experience that's being referred to here. Okay. Now, the first verse that we're looking at is working with anger.